Thank you, Brother Chadwell. And thank all of you who've had a part in making this possible today. This has already been a great day, if we don't do anything else, all day. What happened this morning so filled me with thanksgiving that I can hardly restrain applauding them. And I'm confident that what will happen today, this afternoon, will merely extend that which was established this morning. I consider the judgment used by the school in arranging for this today was good judgment in the men they chose for this morning. I've not known Brother Kelsey as long as I've known Brother Floyd, but I knew of him, and what he did this morning is exactly what I knew he would do. I've known Brother Floyd for 25 years, and of the two men that I can recall, there were three really at Lipscomb, that I just loved with an endearing and enduring love. One was J. Ridley Stroop, and another was Batsel Barrett Baxter, and another was Harvey Floyd. Harvey was much younger than these other men, but I saw in him something that arrested my attention. And I think of all the young men that I saw, Harvey Floyd manifested the Spirit of Christ then in a way that was so singular and outstanding that it captured my attention and my affection. And he's not lost any of that spirit, but rather gained in it. And so I'm just thankful to be here and to be among these great men. Brother Warren and I will attempt to extend what they did this morning. I think my first impressions of Brother Warren were regarding his well-known sermon, Marriage is for Those That Love God and Each Other. And I believe that's the first impression that I ever had of him, and it was one of great respect. Well, I was really cut out to be a debater, but they sold me up wrong. I've looked forward to this day with mixed emotions, really, like the man, I guess, that watched his mother-in-law drive over the cliff in his new Cadillac. And I kind of do that on purpose to kind of relax and let you relax. I've not come today to defend a position. I've only come to explain one. And I came this morning to listen objectively. I'll be listening objectively today as Brother Warren speaks. I urge you also to give me that same gift. Would you listen objectively to me in search of the truth, because that's all we're wanting. I want you to write down your questions, and I'll make every effort to answer every question that you ask me regarding the material that I present. But now, obviously, I can't claim to answer all the questions that can be raised on the subject of marriage and divorce. I don't have all the answers. I don't even know all the questions. Nor do any of you know all the questions. And there are a lot of them that can be raised. But on the material that I present, I am more than anxious to answer your questions, and we'll do that at the time of the question and answer period. If I don't know an answer, I'm just going to tell you I don't know. Is that all right? We had men do that this morning, and so I think I'll just do the same thing. Furthermore, if I find that I know of some men in the congregation today who know more about it than I do, I'm going to feel free to just say, well, let them answer that. We had some heavyweights on this morning, men in the Greek language who know, you know, they're, who am I? I've worked in the Greek language for 25 years. And I know enough about the Greek to know that I don't know enough about the Greek. But we've got some men here, I think, who do. May God bless us as we study together. Would you pray with me? Loving Father, we come to you today like children. We're searching for the Spirit of Jesus Christ, your Son. We're searching for his truth on this very important issue. Lord, lead us gently and help us to consider each other better than ourselves. In Jesus' name, amen. In attempting to outline this today, I came to the conclusion that there are many things upon which we all agree. One thing that we are in agreement on is that we're in agreement on the law itself. The law of Christ on marriage and divorce in Matthew the 19th chapter is stated essentially in verse 9, but in its completeness in verses 3 through 9. But if you were to paraphrase it, I would like to read it for you first before we go any further. After they discussed with him and asked him the question, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? He answered, have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. So they're no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. That's the original divine intent of God. They said to him, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and put her away? And he said to them, for the hardness of your heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for unchastity and marries another commits adultery. Now that's the law stated in its fullest extent. If we were to paraphrase that, it would be this, and we're all in agreement with this, I would suspect 99% of us. One man for one woman for life, with one exception, that being fornication on the part of one of the partners, that makes divorce an option but not mandatory. And I think we're all in agreement on that. So I thought I'd start where all of us are in agreement and then work from there to some things perhaps in which we disagree but can find agreement. There's another area in which we agree. We're most all, though perhaps not totally, in agreement on the application of that law that's to be made to Christians. As far as what we're to preach from pulpits such as this, as far as what we're to teach our young people, I think we're all almost totally in agreement. One man for one woman for life, with just one exception, if that has to be. It's not mandatory, but it's an option. Fornication on the part of one of the partners. I think we're also in agreement on what's to be done when there are flagrant violations by Christians. I think all of us would agree with what I did some months ago when a lady called me from Texas and said, Brother Woodruff, I have a friend. And 10 years ago, this friend, who is a Christian, met a man who is a Christian, and they fell in love. The man was married to a Christian woman, but he told this young girl that she was what he'd been looking for all of his life. And so he divorced his Christian wife and married this Christian girl. And now it's been 10 years, and they have 3 children by that marriage. What must they do? And so I said to her, you're that friend, aren't you? And she just became uncontrollably distraught. She said, yes. And I asked her, I said, ma'am, what on earth made you act in direct contradiction to what your Lord said would be the rule of his kingdom? How could you go just diametrically opposed to him? And she said, well, she said, we thought he would forgive us. What would you have told her? I think I know what 99% of us would have told her. I said, well, if you're expecting me to condone an outright flagrant violation of the law that Christ gave you, and you did it knowingly, being one of his disciples, if you think that I'm going to condone it and say, well, just be sorry for it and stay where you are, I said, you've called the wrong man. I can't do it. I think we're in agreement. There wouldn't be a church in the United States that would be written up for having made that decision. You would have endorsed it at least, or would have allowed them to make that decision. So I think we're in agreement on it. But we're also in agreement another way. We're not in agreement, but we're together. We're together in that we're all forced to make an application to people who are in the world who have violated that law and are wanting to become Christians. We're all together in this because all of us are having to make applications to that condition, that predicament. Now, those of you who are out beating the bushes will know what I mean. Those of you who are out running buses in a bus program to churches, you know what I mean. The only people that are not being forced to make application of this marriage law to the human predicament that we find so prevalent today are those who are not out in the bushes or who are not out on the buses. It's not like one brother told me once. He said, where in the world are you coming across all these divorced and remarried people? He said, I don't find all that many coming down the aisle. Well, I said, if you'll raise any rock, 8 or 10 will run out from under it. So we're together in the sense that we're going to have to make an application. Now, as usual, I forgot my pen. My marker is in there. I really need it. But if anybody has a magic marker that's water dissoluble, I'll accept it. Thank you. It's coming down. The fact that we're going to have to make an application is, it's too obvious to ignore. Those of you, perhaps, who would advocate separation, thank you, those of you who would advocate separation, you need to understand that that is an application. Those of you who advocate that those marriages are to abide, you need to understand that that also is an application. But you see, in Matthew 19, 3 through 9, Jesus didn't make the applications. He just simply stated the law. It's up to you and me when the human predicament presents itself for us to make an application of that law to the human predicament. Now, there are those who don't like to make that concession to me. They say, no, that's not right. Now, you're making a distinction between the law and the application. No, I'm just simply saying that it's a valid distinction to say that there is a difference in the sense that there is a difference between law as it is stated and then the application of that law as it is stated. Now, if you can ever grant that possibility, that you, if you say that these marriages that are in existence prior to a person becoming a Christian, that if you advocate that they separate, that's an application. And those of you who advocate that they abide, that's also an application. Now let me give you an illustration of how that is valid. Jesus, while he was here on earth in his personal ministry, found himself always making application of the law to existing conditions. He always found himself running head on into Pharisees and Sadducees who were more than willing to just simply quote the law and, quote, let the chips fall where they may. And he found himself being ostracized and condemned because he insisted on making application of the law to the human predicament. The place, I guess, in the law that was most often applied by Jesus was the law of the Sabbath. There was something about it. He was forever doing something on the Sabbath, and they were forever condemning him and criticizing him and quoting the law of the Sabbath. But the law of the Sabbath is found in Exodus, the 20th chapter, verses 8 through 11. You're familiar with it. We'll not read it for fear we'll not have enough time left for something else. But the law just simply says that, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall work and do all your labor. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord, and you shall not work on it. But in Luke, the 13th chapter, verses 10 through 17, you're familiar with that event in his life. Luke says he was teaching on the Sabbath one day in one of their synagogues. And there came in a woman who had an infirmity. She was bent over double and couldn't stand up. And she had been that way for 18 years. And they were watching him to see what he would do. And he called the woman to him and laid his hands upon her and said, "Woman, you're freed from your infirmity." Well, the ruler of the synagogue stood up and said, "Now, I have an announcement to make." He said, "There are 6 days on which men ought to work. You come on those days to be healed and not on the Sabbath." Now watch what he did. He just simply quoted the law and set it up there in front of this woman and said that it is not lawful, Jesus, for you to do good on the Sabbath day. The ruler made an application of the law at the expense of the suffering of the sufferer. But watch what Jesus did. He wasn't willing to do that. Jesus healed her on the Sabbath day. And first of all, after he had healed her, then he pointed out to these people that they were hypocrites. He said, "Which of you, having an ox or an ass, will not loose him from his manger on the Sabbath and lead him away to water him?" Now, he said, should not this woman, who is a daughter of Abraham, who has been bound by Satan for, lo, these 18 years, was it not right to loose her on the Sabbath? And then it said, all of his adversaries were put to shame, and I should think so. But you see what he did? He made an application of the law. Look again. Well, first of all, let me give you one or two more thoughts on that. In Matthew, the 12th chapter, verse 12, he makes an interpretation and an application of that principle of the law and makes this statement. He said, "It is lawful, therefore, to do good on the Sabbath." And you see, there's another application. That's an interpretation and an application of the law. That had reference to a man whose hand was withered. Look again in John 7:24. Jesus instructs these people to not judge by appearances. Now, that was after the healing of a man that was lame or crippled for all these years. He had been healed on the Sabbath, and they were uptight over that. And he showed them again how they were inconsistent in condemning him for making a man completely whole on the Sabbath, while they had condoned or endorsed the people who circumcised on the Sabbath in order to keep from breaking the law. He said, "Shouldn't a man be made totally whole? Do you condemn me for making a man totally whole since you on the Sabbath day circumcised to keep from breaking the law?" And then he made this very pointed instruction as though a judge were instructing a jury. He said, don't make surface judgments. He called it appearances. Don't judge by appearances. Judge with right judgment. Don't make simplistic solutions. And I heard these brethren this morning, and it was so thrilling to hear them say, "Well, I need to hear the case. I need to talk to the people." They were doing what Jesus advised to be done. Don't make simplistic solutions. Don't make judgment by appearances. But there's another case in Matthew, the 12th chapter, verses 1 through 8, here again on the Sabbath day. And it tells of Jesus allowing physical needs of his own disciples to be met on the Sabbath day. The Pharisees were watching, and the disciples were going through the grain field, and they plucked some of the grain and took it, and I guess they rubbed it in their hands, which I'm told was against the law, and they ate it. And then the Pharisees said, "Look, what are they doing that which is not lawful to do on the Sabbath day? Why are they doing that?" And then Jesus also gave them some instruction about how that they were inconsistent, but we'll not get into that. But he makes two statements. In one, in Mark, the 2nd chapter, in verse 27, in the parallel passage, where he makes this observation, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." And he says to them, "You misunderstand the nature and the purpose of the Sabbath, for one thing. It was the Sabbath that was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." But their way of looking at the law of the Sabbath was that men had been made in order to satisfy the demands of the Sabbath. Jesus said, that's not the way it was. The Sabbath was made in order to satisfy the needs of man. Now, back to this case, though, in Matthew 12, where we referred to just a moment ago in the original story, he comes with this final statement and urges this balance to be given to this subject. He said, "If you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you wouldn't have condemned the guiltless." He said, if you'd only looked at it through the eyes of God, because he quotes an Old Testament statement And Jesus quotes this one as much as he quotes any statement in the New Testament from the Old Testament. He said, if you'd just known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you wouldn't have condemned the guiltless. On another occasion, he said, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. But there's another one that I won't get into in detail. I don't have the time. But if you really want to get one, go to John, the 8th chapter, verses 1 through 11, where he took the woman who'd been caught in adultery. And this incident here was not a matter of interpretation. She had been caught in the act. And the law had stipulated that she was to be stoned. And as was mentioned this morning, we don't know when they stopped stoning them, but they were still hanging prophets. And they were trying to hang Jesus more than they were trying to stone her. But Jesus there, you see, dismisses her accusers, takes her, doesn't excuse her sin or deny that she did sin, but he does forgive her and calls her to a higher plane of living. Now, I mention that to just simply show you that Jesus, in opposition to the Pharisees, who were willing to quote the law at the expense of the sinner, Jesus himself looked for a way to take the sinner where he was, forgive him, and then lead him to a higher plane of keeping the law. And that's important. Now you say, well, what are you telling us all this for? I thought this was a discussion on marriage and divorce. Well, it is. But if I can get us to see that Jesus had to make application of the law to the human predicament, if we can see that, that Jesus had to make application of the law, and he wasn't willing to do like the Pharisees, to just quote the law and let the sinner bear the brunt of it. Jesus looked for a way to apply the law to the human predicament in such a way that he could save the human and also lead them to keep the law. Now, if we can see that Jesus did this, then we'll be able to catch his spirit. And if we can catch the way that he did it and see which way he leaned, as the law was brought into connection or into contact with the human predicament, if we can just see which way he leaned and what his spirit was, then those who are trying to follow the Spirit of Christ will get a glimpse and will catch an idea about how to make application of the Matthew 19:9 law as it meets the human predicament today. Okay, and you understand why I'm doing that? All right, now that's really lesson number one. And actually, there are just four simple lessons that I'm going to give you today. That's lesson number one. And that is, if we can catch the Spirit of Jesus Christ and find out how it was that he resolved these conflicts and how he brought the law of God into contact with the human predicament without destroying the sinner, if we can catch that, then we'll be better prepared to make the application of this particular law. All right, number two. With what we've just said in mind, let's look at the background and the setting that prevailed in the first century period. The background and setting of Matthew 19, 1 through 9, or 3 through 9, is what we're looking for. The issue, really, as we've learned this morning, was the scriptural grounds for divorce and remarriage. Now, the Pharisees in Matthew 19 and 3 try to involve Jesus in the legislation in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. And they want to involve him, you see, in the conflict between Hillel and Shammai. And they've already explained to you what that conflict was. I'll not go into it any further, except to say that the interpretation of Hillel prevailed in the time of Jesus. But they were trying to get him to get involved in this. They were wanting him to get involved in Deuteronomy, the 24th chapter, and that's should be 24, just 1 through 4. They were trying to get him to make an interpretation or to make some kind of a comment upon this. Jesus wouldn't allow them to press him there. He took them back over to Genesis, the second chapter, verses 18 through 25, to the original law. And that was beautifully done this morning. And I didn't realize until I was preparing for this that the original law really didn't make any provision for divorce. All it made provision for was marriage. Jesus made provision later on for divorce for one reason, but they wanted him to get involved in this discussion here. But he wouldn't talk about divorce until he first talked about marriage. And after he got through talking about marriage and telling them that God made them one man for one woman for life, they then asked him the question, well then, why then did Moses command them to give a writing of divorcement and put her away? What was the purpose, or why did he do it? And Jesus then gives two statements that gave them the reason for doing this, and it also gives us an insight into the nature of that Mosaic legislation. First of all, he mentions something that I'm going to mention second, that I'll switch them, but you'll see why. He says, from the beginning it was not so, indicating that Moses had made a change in the law regarding marriage. The second statement that he makes, and he makes it first, he says it was because of the hardness of your heart that Moses allowed this to be done. But from the beginning it wasn't so. So you find Jesus making these two statements, and they are both they indicate the real nature of the law of Moses. First of all, from these two statements, we must conclude that Moses did make a change in the marriage law. There's no question about that. And secondly, we're forced to conclude that Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, was not just a concession in the original law, but was a limitation, a restriction, occasioned by prior conditions among the Jews. They were putting off and on wives to the point that it was an absolute scandal. It was a disgrace. It was a corruption of the land. So what I'm saying here is that instead of Moses making just a concession of the original law of marriage and bringing it down to this plane here, that is not really what was done. Moses, Jesus said, it was because of the hardness of your hearts that Moses did it. That's the reason for it, which implies that Moses was bringing them up from a pit of practice that was much lower than the one to which he called them. And actually, then, what he was doing with the Mosaic restriction was placing a restriction on their pre-law practice. They had been living like they had been putting off a wife, and the Deuteronomic legislation just simply says, when you put off a wife and then she marries another and he puts her away, you can't take her back. That's a corruption of the land. You must not do that. And so we find that that's what he was referring to, and that the Mosaic legislation actually was not just a concession of this law, it was a restriction on their previous practice. Now, if you can understand that, and I think I came across a principle that I believe will make us know that that's exactly what he did. The main reason why I know that that's true, other than Jesus saying it was because of the hardness of your hearts that he allowed that, is this second principle, and that is that God, to my knowledge, and you may have more knowledge than I on this, and if you do, I want you to say so, but God, to my knowledge, has never in all the Bible ever made a law that intended to bring men down from a higher law down to a lower one. You understand what I'm saying? God never did make a law that was intended to lower men's morals rather than elevate them. Now, if you know of one, I'm open. But he didn't. Every time God ever made a law, it was to elevate morals rather than to bring them down to a lower plane. So for that reason, and this isn't any particular key realization, except that it opened up a door to me that I saw that rather than God bringing his law down for no reason, it wasn't that. He issued this Mosaic restriction in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, for the purpose of bringing the Jews up. That was the purpose of it. So we must conclude that Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, was the first step back up to the original law that God had given over here in the creation to begin with. Now, the Mosaic restriction in Deuteronomy 24 was not the original law of God. Jesus says, no, it wasn't like this from the beginning. It was different. It wasn't the original law, nor was it even Jesus' restatement of the law as he gave it in Matthew 19, 3 through 9. Because there he adds an exception that allows divorce for the cause of fornication. So this restrictive part here of Mosaic legislation was neither the original law, nor was it the restated law by Jesus. It was actually what you might call a halfway house. The Mosaic legislation provided a halfway house between what the Jews were before the law was given and what he wanted them to be ultimately. And so this provided a halfway house. And this is the law that was in force for 1400 years among the Jewish people. That was the law that prevailed for 1400 years. And not only was that the law that prevailed, but the interpretation of Hillel by the time of the coming of Christ was what prevailed And as was given this morning, this brought about such a tremendous low in their morals, and divorce became just commonplace. Now, you say, well, what does all this mean? Well, it simply shows that the historical condition that prevailed for 1,400 years among the Jews was this. They were allowed to divorce and remarry on grounds other than fornication, and that this was the law that prevailed at the time of the coming of Christ. You see, the law of Jesus wasn't the law that prevailed at that time. This was the law that prevailed among the Jews. And the Gentiles didn't even have the benefit of that. You see, they were still down there living like pigs. And let me see if I can't... This is the conclusion that I want you to see. The Jews, for 1,400 years, were allowed to divorce and remarry for reasons other than fornication or adultery. And the Gentiles didn't even have the benefit of that Mosaic restriction that would stop them from doing some of the things that the Jews had done prior to the coming of the law. So, what I'm really saying, and this is lesson number two. Lesson number one now is, can we catch a glimpse of what Jesus did and what his spirit was as the law came into contact with the human predicament? That's lesson number one. If we can learn that, we'll be well on our way. Lesson number two, what was the human predicament at the time that Jesus lived? The human predicament was simply this. And I want you to notice, this line shouldn't be in the chart. And incidentally, these charts, I have enough here today on a piece of paper, miniature chart, for every one of us to have one. This law really shouldn't even be in there at that place, because that's not where, that's just not where it was. The law that Jesus stated here, the original, the restatement of it, was not that law that prevailed at that time. These were the laws that prevailed. Let me just draw a line there and then put this line right straight on across. And we'll have to conclude that the people who lived during the time of Jesus lived in this strata of morality right in here. They weren't up here at all. And that was attested this morning and documented clearly. That's where they were. They were down here, not up here. Well, now, what do you say, well, why are you telling us all that? For the simple reason that we can't know how that the law was applied until we know what the human predicament was. And we can't even talk about scriptural marriages until we know what scriptural marriage was in the first century. As Brother Kelsey, I think, said this morning, there were no unscriptural marriages on the day of Pentecost. They were all scriptural. If you'll look at it scriptural in the sight of the law of Moses... Now, if you're talking about scriptural in the light of Matthew 19 and 9, no. But Matthew 19 and 9 wasn't the law that was prevailing at that time. The marriages had for 1,400 years been prepared by the Mosaic law and the Roman and Greek law, which allowed marriage and divorce on grounds other than fornication. So what you have at the time of the coming of the day of Pentecost and the coming of the Christian era, you have an entire world whose lifestyle was determined and patterned after the legislation that was given through Moses and the Roman people and the Greeks. Now, that's very important. Now, do I need to document that? It's documented on the notes. I've got all this. It's all for you. I'm not going to have time if I read all this. Are you satisfied? But the reason I can't leave you now dangling, because you've got to grant me this one. You know, if you say, oh no, that wasn't the condition of the first century, then I'm afraid I'm going to have to read all this. Understand, is this right? Do you understand that this was the condition? It was a terrible mess. And this was stated this morning. But now, I don't want to leave you, because see, if you don't grant this one concession and say, yes, we understand that that was the condition, if you don't grant that, I can't go on any further. Are we already pretty well in agreement? Okay, and then if there's any question. All right. That's all right. That's a good question. But as far as the bulk of the whole of the world, see, this is all they had. This is all the law that the remnant had. See, they didn't have any other law either. The remnant had been living under the Mosaic law for say, 1,400 years. Okay, I think probably I'll just let you have this later. I'm going to give it to you after we're dismissed. Well, you can buy it for a quarter. Okay, now, what application, the next question then that comes, we've already seen now that the Spirit of Jesus Christ, if we can catch that as the law met the human predicament, then if we've seen what the human predicament is, now the question really is, what application of Matthew 19 and 9 did the first century church make to the prevailing condition? What application did the first century church make to that prevailing human predicament? Now the human predicament we're talking about is this: a world filled with people who had divorced and remarried on grounds other than fornication. And that condition was allowed by both the law of Moses and the civil law of both Greeks and Romans. That's the human predicament we're talking about. Now the question that I have today is simply this, and that's why what you really wanted to know. What application did the first century church make to the human predicament now of this law of Christ in Matthew 19 and 9? Question: did they require those marriages that had been formed on laws less than the Christian law, did they require those marriages to separate or to continue? What application was made? Now here was the condition down here, as we were noticing, Jew and Gentile. They were brought into contact with the gospel. What at this point here, what application of Matthew 19 and 9 was made to the human predicament as it existed here? And you just might want to look at that as the day of Pentecost right there. What application was made? Well, did they require those marriages formed on laws less than the Christian standard to separate? Well, there's no command or example for such an application. Not a command, not an example. Now, in the absence of both, and there may be a question in your mind, I'll come to it in just a moment, but in the absence of both an example and a command, by what authority do men make such an application today? Now, there are those who are saying that those marriages must be broken up. But upon what authority? There is no command to break them up, and there's no example of where they were ever broken up. Let me give you what Foy Wallace Jr. says on it. In his Sermon on the Mount and Civil State, page 41, and this also is in the notes that you will be receiving, Foy Wallace Jr. says, of these marriages that had what we know of as unscriptural bases, the divorces were not proper, the remarriage wasn't proper, he simply says that Christ omitted legislating a disciplinary procedure, indicating that such a legalized relation becomes a principle of moral conduct between the parties involved and God, and is left to his own judicial decision, not ours. With no course of action legislated, revealed, or prescribed, we cannot make one without human legislation. The course of some preachers in demanding separations and the breaking up of family relations and the refusal to even baptize certain ones whose marriage status does not measure up to his standard of approval is a presumptuous procedure, more far-reaching in evil consequences than the moral effects of divorcement limited to the persons involved. It is certain that if the Lord Jesus Christ had intended a course of action in these cases, he would not have left it for preachers to prescribe, but would have himself legislated it. Now, that's a pretty clear statement by Foy Wallace regarding this particular question. Now, some of you may be saying, but now wait a minute, we do have an example of it. We have an example where a marriage was told to break up, and that's back in Matthew 14 and verse 4, and it's regarding Herod. Herod had seized John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John said to him, "It is not lawful for you to have her." Now, there are those who say, now this is an example of a marriage being broken up that was an improper marriage. That's right. But the thing that is often overlooked is that this was an incestuous marriage. You see, Herod had his brother Philip's wife. That's what was wrong with it. For you see, as we've already noticed this morning, and as I've already noticed this afternoon, the law of Moses gave Herod and gave Philip the right to divorce and remarry on grounds other than fornication. But if you look back in Leviticus, the 18th chapter and verse 16, and Leviticus 20 and verse 21, you'll find that the law absolutely forbade any man taking his brother's wife. This was an example of incest, and it doesn't fit the pattern we're talking about at all. I know what to do about incestuous marriages. Let's look again. Look at 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, verses 1 through 5, and you're familiar with that. Here a man was living with his father's wife. Well, what are you going to do about that? Well, that's, again, it's a matter of incest. It wasn't a matter of a man being married and divorced and remarried on grounds other than fornication. For you see, the law allowed that. That was a scriptural marriage according to the law. This was an example of incest. A man had his father's wife, and Paul said that at that time, even the Gentiles weren't even acting like that. But if you look at Leviticus, the 18th chapter and verse 8, it specifically forbids any man to uncover his father's nakedness. In other words, to lie with his father's wife. He says, that's your father's nakedness. You shall not do it. So these two examples, Matthew 14 and 4 with Herod, and 1 Corinthians 5, 1 through 5, and verse 13, are examples of incestuous marriages, you see. And so you can't cite them as examples of people being broken up whose marriages did not meet the standard of Matthew 19 and 9. All right, now, I don't have any question at all about what to do about incestuous marriages. Do any of you? I don't have a question at all. I know what to do about them. If it's an incestuous marriage, I've got an example and a command. In fact, Paul says you either separate or put him out from it. He said, get rid of the wicked man. Put him out from you. If he won't break up with her, it seems like maybe later in 2 Corinthians that the man did. That he may have corrected it. It implies that at least. But here, we know what to do about incestuous marriages, so we're all agreed on that. But no other example of any other marriage ever being broken up in the New Testament. We just don't have it. Not a one. Then where is our authority for breaking up those marriages today? There isn't any. Now that's lesson number 3. Lesson number 1, see if we can catch a glimpse of the Spirit of Jesus as He made application of law to the human predicament. See if you can catch that Spirit of His, which way He leaned. Secondly, find out what the human predicament was in the first century. Thirdly, when we find out what that human predicament was and we know what His law is, what application did the first century church make of that law to that human predicament? And you come to this conclusion, there's not a single example of where anybody was ever told to break up a marriage whose marriage did not meet the standard of Matthew 19 and 9. There's just not an example there. That's lesson number 3. Well, look again. Then did the first century church allow those marriages formed on laws less than the Christian standard to continue? Did they tell them that they were to abide? Well, J.D. Thomas says they did. He says that the New Testament church made that approach to it. And this material also is in the notes. Listen to this statement. It is urged or argued that the Hebrews 13:4 passage was addressed to Hebrews who had known more than one ground for divorce in their tradition, and that a rigid application of Matthew 19 and 9 would even void all the Jewish second marriages Mosaic concession of the early Christian converts that did not have fornication as the grounds for their previous divorces. And thus, they'd all have had to have put away their mates immediately upon becoming Christians. Such a conclusion is not valid, however. For, now notice, when God once recognized a particular marriage relation in one dispensation as approved, He would not change this simply because of a change in covenants. It was not a retroactive matter. If any marriage was legitimate in God's sight before the couple became Christians, it would still be so afterward. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? You see, we have this example, at least he believes, that the first century church allowed those Christians who had come into that relationship, into Christianity, who were already divorced and remarried and divorced and remarried. Brother Thomas says that those were allowed to continue because the matter was not retroactive. It didn't go back and make all of them adulterers because that former law did not measure up to the law of Jesus Christ. Now, but if you were to ask me, how much time have I got left? About 15 minutes? It's about 15 minutes, all right. If you were to ask me, Brother Woodruff, do you believe that the New Testament allowed those marriages to continue? I would say, and I'd do this, it would kind of take you by, this wouldn't really be honest, but I would say no, I don't. That. You see, it's not a matter with me. I don't believe the New Testament just allows them to continue. I believe the New Testament teaches that they don't have any option. Just as the men this morning said, they didn't have any option. They were told, you stick into that marriage. Oh, but somebody says, those were scriptural marriages they were talking about. Scriptural in what sense? In Matthew 19 and 9? No, that wasn't the law that was prevailing then. The law that prevailed at the time of the coming of Christ, and the only law that those people knew that they had been under for 1,400 years, was the law that allowed them to divorce and remarry on grounds other than fornication, and that was both by God through the law of Moses and the Romans and the Greeks under their own civil laws. Now, so I say that it required them to stay. It required them to remain. But when you use this word remain, you're driven to a certain particular place in the New Testament, and that's 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, verses 12 through 24. Would you turn with me in your Bibles to that? 1 Corinthians 7, 12 through 24. And incidentally, this is the fourth lesson, and that's all I've got. These four lessons. One, see if you can't determine the Spirit of Jesus as He brought laws into the human predicament and how He settled it. Secondly, find out what the human predicament was. And it was terrible. Thirdly, there is no example of anybody being separated, not a one. Fourthly, we do have a whole section where the main emphasis is stay in there. Remain. Now notice, if you will. First of all, the whole chapter is on marriage itself. 40 verses, it's the most extensive treatment of marriage in the whole New Testament. 40 whole verses on this subject. Secondly, notice this. Verses 12 through 24. 12 through 24. Have to do with what's to be done with these existing marriages. Give us some idea, Paul, about what's to be done with these marriages that are already in existence. And I want you to notice something, that all of this legislation of 1 Corinthians 7, 12 through 24, all of this specific instruction on marriage, existing marriages, it only goes back to the point of conversion. It only goes back to the point of conversion. It doesn't go back behind there. It talks about the condition at the point of conversion. Now notice, if you will, look at verses 12 and 13. If any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. And I wasn't going to say this, but Brother Floyd mentioned it this morning, and I'll just mention it. You see, this talks about what they had at the time of their conversion, because in 2 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, they were forbidden to go out and marry an unbeliever. They weren't to be unequally yoked with unbelievers. I believe that either means marriage. It includes marriage or doesn't include anything. You can't get any closer to somebody than marrying them. So it forbids the Christian to go out and select an unbeliever, but whenever two heathen or two Jews were married and one of them became a Christian and the other didn't, then it left this unequal yoking in a sense. But Paul says stay in there with him. Notice, if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, let him not divorce her, or he should not divorce her. But the point I'm making is that if any brother has a wife at the point of the conversion, at the point where the situation existed, he should not divorce her. No questions were asked. He didn't say if any brother who has had a marriage that was based upon, that. He just says if any brother has a wife, stay there with her. Don't put her away. Do not divorce her. Now, look at these two illustrations of this. To illustrate it, he chooses two subjects that are really kind of out of place unless they are illustrations. He brings up slavery and circumcision. Well, what in the world is he bringing up circumcision and slavery in a discussion on marriage? Well, they're illustrations of the permanency of that condition that existed at the point of the call. Now notice, if you will, look at verse 17. Only let everyone lead the life which the Lord has assigned to him and in which God has called him. That's injunction number one. Injunction number one. Excuse me, let's go back. Let me get the illustrations first. Look at verse 18. We'll come to that in just a moment. I want you to look at verse 18 first, talking about these two illustrations. verse 18 says, was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? You see, that's pretty strong language. I'll have to admit that it's not all that strong in the Greek language. It is in a sense, but I went back there thinking, you know, you'd have exclamation points and underlining all this. It doesn't really have all that. They're just some tenses of verbs that are best translated in this very explicit way. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Then let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. But look again. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision. Then look at verse 21. Were you a slave when you were called? Never mind. Now, why would he use these two illustrations, or why would he use these two figures, unless he were illustrating the very thing that he said about the man who had the unbelieving wife when he was called? The conclusion that he draws is found in verse 17. Only let everyone lead the life which the Lord has assigned to him and in which God has called him. Secondly, look at verse 20. Everyone should remain in the state in which he was called. Look at verse 24. So, brethren, in whatever state each was called, there let him remain with God. And then look at 17b. This is my rule in all the churches. Now, you can't get any clearer than that. He says, if any man has an unbelieving wife, stay with her. Illustration number one, were you at the time of your call already circumcised? Don't try to become uncircumcised. Were you uncircumcised? Don't try to become whatever. Don't try to become circumcised. And then he says, were you a slave at the time of your call? Don't worry about it. But then he just simply says, bang, 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 live in that life in which God called you. Everyone should remain in the state in which he was called. And then in whatever state he was called, therein let him remain with God. That's principle number four. Stay in there with it. Now, qualification. This has to do only with those relationships that are honorable. Only those relationships that are legal. Only those relationships that have that quality about them. Because you see, all other illegal and dishonorable relationships are taken care of in chapter 6. And if you'll notice here, all dishonorable relationships were to cease. Turn back to chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians and notice. Latter part of verse 9, do not be deceived. Neither the immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor robbers will inherit the kingdom of God. And such were some of you. But you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified. But notice all these illegal relationships. And you say, ah, but look there, he says adulterers. Yes, but that's extramarital adultery. He's not talking about those marriages that had been formed on bases less than the Christian standard, you see, because that was legal. That's the law that prevailed in that whole time. That's what the whole world consisted of. So you see, you can't put those back there in the list of things in 1 Corinthians 6. It's just you can't put them there. Those marriages that we're talking about are those that the law of Moses allowed, that the laws of the Romans allowed. Certainly you're not going to ask God or expect God to expect more of the Romans than he expected of his own people. They were all in this condition. And it was to them that he says, you stay there. But those were the legal relationships, the legal laws, the what you would call the scriptural laws by the law of Moses. Now, thirdly, there are three honorable relationships that are to abide. These are marriage and singleness, circumcision and uncircumcision, and slavery and freedom. These three were to abide. But you say, why? Well, first of all, let's notice the marriage and singleness, or the marriage relationship, that talks about the domestic relationship. Circumcision and uncircumcision, that was the ethnic relationship. Slavery and freedom was the social economic relationship. Well, you say, why did he allow these to abide, just simply stating, let them abide? Why did he not go in there and try to break up all these things? Why did he do that? For this simple reason. These three distinctions, if you'll turn quickly to Galatians, the third chapter, and verse 28, you're going to find there the same three distinctions and wonder why he mentions them again. Well, I'll tell you why in just a moment. In verse 28 of chapter 3, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, Now you see there, those three are again. Jew nor Greek, that's the national distinction. Slave nor free, that was the social or economic distinction. And then male nor female, that was the domestic or sexual distinction. But why does he single out these three distinctions in both these places? For this simple reason. These three relationships are the three pillars upon which civilization rests. You rip away the domestic distinction and destroy all the homes, you destroy society. You rip away the economic distinction, or at that time, slave and master, and you'd destroy another. You'd destroy the society. Or you rip away the national distinction, and you have such a confusion that the society just pretty well would be gone. Now listen to this statement. These three great distinctions, such are the great distinctions. Thomas Charles Edwards makes this statement. Such are the great distinctions, natural, national, social, on the maintenance of which, in any particular age or country, the preservation of the principles of liberty and order and their legitimate development in human history mainly depend. Marriage, circumcision, slavery, and the relationships that they represent. Now, all right, let me give you an illustration, and I'm about through. Sometimes issues are so emotion-packed that we can't make a real rational, objective application of the law to them. They're kind of like giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to this Farrah Fawcett major. It's hard to do that without getting emotionally involved. I thought a long time before I decided to do that. You know what they do to teach you how to give mouth-to-mouth resuscitation? They don't bring her in. They bring in a dummy. You know, just lying there, dead as a coot, lifeless, no color, no nothing. And they let you learn on that. Then when you've got that learned, then you're ready for the real live situation. Now watch. That's what we find in this situation here. We're so keyed up on this thing of divorce and remarriage, we can't make a rational, calm, objective decision about it. But we've got something we can use as a dummy. And that's this matter of slavery. And this won't even hurt any of us. We'll just be able to do it. There won't be any pulse increase at all. You just watch. Slavery, as it existed in the first century, was not God's first best plan. You know that. Oh, the abuse was terrible. It provided the utmost in opportunities for sexual license, everything. It was just terrible. That was not God's first best choice. It was not his first best plan. And yet we know that that was precisely the first condition of the first century situation. That was it. That was the whole scene, the social and economic arrangement of the first century was that. You know what the Christians told people to do who were slaves, who were in that situation? Well, when Onesimus ran away from Philemon, what did Paul do? Paul said, right, get back there and organize an uprising and get those kids out of there, get those slaves out of there. Oh, no, he said, go back in. You stay there. Why? Because they depended on elevating the relationship and eventually eliminating it altogether. And that's exactly what happened. Now, that didn't hurt, did it? Because none of us have been slaves, and none of us are slaves, and none of us are masters, and we're probably not a slave within 1,000 miles from here. But watch. Now we get nervous. The divorce and remarriage and divorce and remarriage that existed in the first century, that wasn't God's first best plan either. Man, he didn't want that. But we also know history documents it to the hilt. That's precisely what it was in existence in the first century. The law of Moses allowed it. The Greek law allowed it. The Roman law allowed it. We know that was it. Well, what kind of an application? All right, here it is. Same thing. In fact, Paul uses this and the treatment of slaves being sent back into the slavery situation. He uses that as an illustration of how also a second-rate situation was to continue among the marriage situation. This is his illustration. Now, are you going to allow him to use his illustration of how that though slavery wasn't God's first best plan, yet they were to abide in it until they could grow up and lead themselves out of it, sanctify that relationship, make it what it ought to be, and then it would eventually disappear. The abuse of it would. And so it is here. Not God's first desire, and yet it was the first century condition. When the law was brought into contact with that first century condition, here was the dictation of what was to be done. Stay in there. Abide. If any man has a brother, stay in there. Abide in that calling. in which you were called. And eventually, by sanctifying those marriage relationships, then the whole situation would eventually take care of itself and divorce would be taken care of eventually, totally. Now, let me give you one final test and we're through. What if it were made universal? Now, learning what we've learned about the situation and all that we've heard today, what if this particular application had been made universal? I mean by that, and that's a test of, that has to be applied to any kind of philosophy or whatever. What if it were made universal? If every person in the Roman Empire had been made a Christian, and every person who had been involved in marriages other than those based upon the law of Matthew 19 and 9 had been required to separate, brethren, it would have destroyed the whole fabric of the Roman Empire. What would happen if the instruction, abide, had been the application of the law? Every marriage in the Roman Empire would have been solidified, it would have been preserved, and divorce would have been eliminated in one fell swoop. Now let me ask you a question. Knowing what you know about the Spirit of Jesus Christ, which of these do you think he would have made? And after all, that's what we're after, is the Spirit of Christ. I think the most encouraging thing in my search, and I've been searching for this for 20 years, these have been my convictions for 20 years, the most convincing and encouraging thing about this is that this is precisely the application that the Apostle Paul makes of the Spirit of Christ that we so clearly recognize as being that which he manifested while he was here on earth. As he brought the law in contact with the human predicament, he found a way to save the sinner and forgive him and lead him on to a higher life of keeping the law. And that's what I'm saying today. I believe that those who come to Christ, having been divorced and remarried on grounds other than fornication, are taken by Christ and forgiven of it, and then led to a higher plane where you just simply tell them, you don't do that ever again. You stay with her from now on. That's what I believe to be the Christ-like application of Matthew 19:9. Oh boy, this has been a good day already, and I'm so thankful for your attention and for your interest in this matter. Thank you.